Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
One of the first things I notice when I walk into Pennington Biomedical Research Center is a giant stained glass window. It's filled with images of healthy living, cast in rainbow colors.
You see there are two wheels here, and there is a cyclist on the top. Wow. And then there is all kind of fruits and vegetable. I mean, it's quite a nice piece of art.
The stained glass window towers above a Pennington entryway. Brightly colored shards of glass depict asparagus, bananas, peas, and a pineapple. The outline of a runner cuts through the background, painted in shades of orange and purple.
And then there is a DNA on the right.
There are blue and pink fish at the bottom, a cantaloupe on the side. The longer I stare, the more symbols of healthy living reveal themselves.
But it's all about what we do. I mean, you know, health, genetics, and biology, and you have all the elements of nutrition, you have the exercise, you have the DNA.
The whole thing makes the place feel like a temple to nutrition, because it kind of is. Pennington is a sprawling research center working to study obesity. Our tour guide today is Eric Ravison, a prominent scientist in the space who is Associate Executive Director for Clinical Science at Pennington. He's the one talking me through all of the stuff in this very large stained glass window. Stained glass is obviously more a feature of churches. But the religious symbolism is sort of fitting, really. This is a place that treats weight loss as a sort of gospel. Pennington has 222 acres of campus, including labs and research facilities, around 200 scientists, and state-of-the-art equipment, much of it dedicated to unlocking the secrets to shedding pounds. It's in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and it feels like a college campus, minus the students. I've been on a journey to get to the bottom of the science of weight loss. And as our stained glass window shows, weight loss is something we all have lots of ideas about. Some of those ideas are actually true, but they're all too often not the whole truth. If anyone could help us sort one from the other, I figured it would be the people here. First, though, we're going to take a look around.
Is this part of the way you test participants? You're like, we're walking up to the fourth floor.
Yeah, we don't take the elevator.
Our first stop is to check out some fairly innocuous-looking medical machinery. It's big and gray and looks almost like a bed.
And is this the machine beginning now?
Yep, it started already. Radiation is on right now. As you can see, the lights are on saying, you know, radiation is on.
This equipment can actually tell you how much of your body is fat and how much of it is muscle and how much is bone. I want to call it a nightmare machine. It's the scan no one wants to see of themselves. But what this equipment really measures is body composition.
And the total, this person here, is 30.6% of the body is fat.
We often talk about the number on the scale like it's the only thing that matters. But this is a good reminder that weight isn't everything. That's why weight loss researchers use tools like these body composition machines. And a big finding they've had is that people vary a lot. People's bodies are different, really, really different. And that's actually at the root of a lot of the findings they've made here at Pennington. But first, back to the tour. We check out a big area known as a metabolic kitchen, where calorically precise foods are prepared for studies. And we walk by spaces that look like hospital rooms. They're also used for research. Eventually, we get to the craziest stop on the tour. We step into a hall that looks into small, furnished rooms.
You know, there's the bathroom, the sink, a curtain, and the bed. And you have everything to be happy. There's TV.
They look like really sad studio apartments. Even though there's furniture, the rooms are sterile looking. There aren't exactly many homey touches. That's because they're actually rooms where scientific research happens. They're called metabolic chambers, and they measure metabolism, like the name suggests. These sad little rooms are designed to measure how many calories the person inside is burning. People stay in them for a good chunk of time, thus all the furniture. Eric also points out that they have windows.
We pass the food and through here.
Outside of the metabolic chambers, in the hallway where we're standing, a bunch of pipes and scientific instruments line the walls. It kind of looks like a boiler room or something. This equipment tracks everything going on in the little rooms. Cool, right? Maybe a little creepy, too? Eric tells me that there are only about 30 metabolic chambers in the world. 30. And Pennington is home to 4 of them. When we arrive, there's actually a woman in one of the rooms already. She's sitting on the bed. It looks like she's scrolling on her phone. Maybe in a little while, she'll go use the adjoining toilet. Watching the stranger live her life in a little box while equipment measures what's going on inside her body is pretty weird, even if it is for science. The whole thing feels a bit dystopian. It makes me think of like a lab rat in a maze or something. Now, she probably can't see this, but a computer screen right behind Eric and I actually shows how many calories she's burning on a minute-by-minute basis. A chart shows us how that rate is changing over time. Eric tells me that while the woman slept, she burned just under a calorie a minute. Then,
I would say she got up here.
He's saying that because we can see on the screen that at this point, her metabolism jumps. People tend to burn more calories as they become more active.
She went to brush her teeth, and her metabolism here goes to 3 calories a minute. And you can see, and at the end of the day, we summarize how many calories she has burned.
The real work of the metabolic chamber is happening silently in the air, because the chamber is actually tracking how much oxygen the woman in the room is taking in and how much carbon dioxide she's breathing out. Why? Well, both oxygen and carbon dioxide are involved in the process of converting food into usable energy. A little math, and ta-da, you have calories burned. This is all part of metabolism, something we usually think about only in terms of how fast we gain or lose weight. And that's definitely part of it. But metabolism is also what keeps us alive and kicking. Something that we should celebrate, not blame. You know how people are always talking about calories in, calories out? A metabolic chamber is a very precise way of calculating the calories out part. Technology like this is really important at places like Pennington, where researchers are digging into the secrets of weight loss. And by the way, some of what they've learned is that calories in, calories out is not the whole story. Not by a long shot. I ask Eric what to make of the numbers the metabolic chamber is spitting out. Would another person burn 3 calories a minute doing the same things as the woman in the room just now? Like, did I burn that much getting ready this morning? That seems like really interesting and even important data to have about yourself.
At any given weight, sex, age, and body composition, you have large variability in between people.
Metabolism differs a lot by person, in other words. Eric couldn't really say if I or another person would burn as many calories a minute as the woman in the room. But he tells me about some research he did way back in the 80s.
We measured people like in these chambers, remeasured them 5 years later, and looked at the relationship between their metabolism and the weight gain. They gain a lot of weight, and we found that a low metabolic rate is a risk factor for weight gain.
Otherwise known as, I have a slow metabolism.
People love to say, I'm gaining weight just because I have a slow metabolism.
But when we say that, do we really know it for sure?
No, you have to measure it.
You have to get into one of the sad little rooms. Metabolism isn't a straight line. It can change over your lifetime, including as you age and when you lose weight. Researchers have learned more about that in recent years, and it may help explain why dieters overwhelmingly regain weight over time. We'll get more into this later. We walk by another suite of rooms with a treadmill and stationary bike. Researchers use these to push people to their exercise limits. It's kind of like a stress test done by a cardiologist, except even more intense. Nearby, a person is actually getting biopsies taken of her fat and muscle. I watch the lab tech, sitting at her microscope, work on a sample. There are actual fat and muscle cells in front of her.
Is there anything you can't measure here?
When it comes to obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, I think we have it all. One of my colleagues used to say it's like Toys R Us for a kid. It's Toys R Us for a scientist.
So, yeah. You're probably realizing by now that this is a place with incredible resources for studying weight loss. And the thing about weight loss is that we all kind of think we know the basics. Losing weight is about eating fewer calories than you burn. Calories in, calories out. Right? In this episode, I'm going to get to the bottom of what we actually know. The science of weight loss. How it's actually a lot more complicated than that simple formula. And we're going to try to figure out why. Why it's so complicated. And why, despite that, the simple formula of calories in, calories out, keeps getting repeated anyway. Not just by your neighbor or uncle, but by doctors and scientists. To do that, we'll start at this mecca of weight loss. But we'll go beyond its walls, too. I'm Bloomberg News health reporter Emma Court. And from the Prognosis podcast, this is Losing It.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/GreenFestival.
Imagine that you're at the doctor's office and they tell you to step onto the scale, which they invariably do, visit after visit. That number is measuring not just your bone, muscle, and fat, but also possibly your lunch from earlier, your shirt and pants, maybe some pee. You can't talk about weight loss without first making sense of weight itself. And what doctors and scientists are concerned about is not your clothing or undigested chopped salad, or even your bone and muscle. They're worried about fat, and specifically, a person having too much fat. So, how does a person get more body fat? That comes back to calories, which we went deep on in our first episode. Remember, calories aren't just a line on a nutrition label. They are a source of energy for your body. Calories are the gas in your car's fuel tank.
Every day we're taking from that tank because we got to move.
This is Leanne Redman. She's an expert in physiology, or how human bodies function. And she works for Pennington.
We've got to digest food, we think, we just function. So every day we've got energy going out of the tank. So every day we have to replenish the energy going into the tank.
To keep your weight the same, ideally you'd be eating around the same number of calories that you burn. Leanne says there's a little wiggle room here of about a few hundred calories a day. But eat too many calories for too long, and that energy has to go somewhere.
It gets stored in the adipose tissue, in the body fat, and then we gain weight, gain adiposity over time, and that eventually leads to obesity.
In other words, fat is another store of energy. We've demonized it the same way we've demonized metabolism, but it actually serves this and other really important functions. Still, extra fat can put a lot of stress on your body. That's why doctors and scientists worry about people having too much fat. A quick note about language here. We will be talking a lot about weight in this episode in particular. Because of the stigma and bias about this subject, there are different schools of thought about how to talk about it. The fat acceptance movement embraces the term fat. Some doctors and scientists favor saying person with obesity. I will talk about it as much as possible the way people do themselves. I have tried to avoid the terms overweight and obese, though I have had to use them at times for clarity's sake. Times like now. Obesity is usually defined as when a person's body mass index is over 30. As a refresher, BMI equals weight divided by height squared. The number is supposed to be a proxy for body fat. But as the formula I just rattled off makes clear, BMI doesn't actually rely on your body's measured fat composition, just weight and height. And BMI is what's overwhelmingly used to talk about weight. Like when rates of obesity in the US began increasing in the 80s. Around this time, government stats show that nearly 60% of American adults were considered too heavy, a 10% increase from an earlier period. That judgment was made using BMI, and it keeps being made using BMI. And it tells us that Americans keep getting heavier. Today, nearly 3/4 of adults are considered by the government to have higher than normal weights. So again, calories matter because extra calories can turn into fat. It's that saying that you've heard so many times before. Calories in, calories out. This is also something we've known for a long time.
When you eat just enough food to supply the energy you need, your weight stays the same. But when you eat more than you burn up in energy, the rest is stored as fat.
So is it really just that simple? Calories in, calories out? The answer is yes, sort of, ish. Not exactly. Calories in, calories out is true, but it's also not true. If you're lost right now, that's okay. I promise it will all make sense by the end of the episode. Remember, we came here to Pennington for a reason. We wanted to sort out, when it comes to weight, what's fact, what's fiction, and what's still a mystery. So, how do we know that calories in, calories out works?
When you walked through this thing that looked like a medical ward to get to the metabolic chambers?
This is Owen Carmichael. He runs the Biomedical Imaging Center at Pennington, So basically some of the fancy machines we've been looking at.
We've actually had studies where people live there and they sleep in those hospital-like beds. They're living in a what looks like a hospital ward. They're interacting with a lot of nurses and they do not have a refrigerator that they have free access to. They cannot order up snacks.
They're in a controlled environment. They're being given calorically precise meals. The sprawling Pennington gym is nearby. For some people, this might sound like the ideal conditions to diet. The VIP diet life. And that's exactly what the scientists intended. For other people, of course, this might sound more like torture. But anyway, Pennington researchers have found that
they really, honest to goodness, lose weight. And they lose fat, not muscle. So it's good weight loss.
People lose weight. At least they do when they spend that whole time at Pennington. But you can't do that for a really long time. Study participants have lives to get back to. And it's exactly when they do that. Step outside the boundaries of Pennington, out into the real world, that the trouble begins.
I think it's very difficult to really wrap your head around how 24/7 this thing we call the obesogenic environment is.
That's scientists speak for the kinds of unhealthy environments that surround us every day. The Danish cart on the corner by your office. Not having a grocery store in your neighborhood. Living somewhere with lots of cars but no sidewalks. If you're lucky enough to have enough to eat, the world can sometimes seem like it's shoving a plate of fries down your throat 24/7. And while you have some limited ability to decline that metaphorical plate of fries, not everything is under your control. We've all experienced this. I even saw it when I was visiting Pennington for this episode. Here I was, speaking with scientists all day long, talking about the importance of healthy eating and portion control and cooking food at home. And meanwhile, I'm staying in a hotel and eating literally all of my meals out. And did I mention that Pennington is based in Louisiana?
A fantastic way to enjoy your local seafood is through the quintessential New Orleans sandwich, a po' boy. I like mine overflowing with fried shrimp.
That thing is as big as you.
Everywhere I went, I kept ordering food without realizing that it was all deep fried. I was at lunch one day with a bariatric surgeon who works at Pennington, and the waiter rattled off a long list of very fried recommendations. Again, my dining companion here does weight loss surgery for a living. It was kind of surreal. When we finished up, they actually brought us a plate of cotton candy, which we had not ordered, for free. And it's not just the environment around us that's making things difficult. It can be us, too. Here's Leanne again.
So it is definitely ultimately about this imbalance in calories, but it's very, very complicated, right? Because there are so many factors that determine what we eat, when we eat, you know, where we're craving something, whether we're full, whether we're hungry or not. And then on the other side, when you reduce people's calories, they're like, oh, I'm eating less, so I'm going to like, I can, you know, move less, right? So they start conserving calories and maybe not as physically active.
The same is true when people are exercising more. They need more calories. And when people start eating less, our bodies respond to that. Remember that calories aren't some inconvenient aspect of Oreos. They're energy. When you have less energy coming in, your metabolism slows down. That actually makes sense if you think about it. Your body is now smaller. So running it, moving it around, that takes less energy. Kind of like how smaller cars can be more fuel efficient. But studies of contestants on the TV show The Biggest Loser have found that metabolism can drop even more than you would expect. Pennington researchers were actually involved in those studies, including Eric Ravison, who took us on the tour earlier.
But we measured all the people from this season 11. It was quite a riot to go to the ranch outside in California.
There's a name for this phenomenon of metabolism slowing more than expected after weight loss. It's called metabolic adaptation. Scientists have also found that after weight loss, hormones that regulate hunger and weight can get disrupted for long periods of time. These hormonal disruptions and metabolic adaptation could help explain why so many people regain weight after dieting. In other words, a person goes on a diet. They regain the weight later. And people assume it's the dieter's fault, right? It seems pretty logical, after all. They say, oh, she stopped eating as many salads. Or that he stopped going to the gym as much. And maybe they say even more unkind things than that. But here's the thing. Scientific research tells us that there may actually be a biological reason for those things happening. That a dieter could be getting really hungry because of hormonal disruptions. That their body might actually be burning way fewer calories after weight loss. When I first learned about this, it kind of blew my mind. Because there seems to be a scientific explanation for why so many dieters regain weight over time. Your body is actively fighting back. And that actually makes sense if you think about evolution. Because bodies need energy to live. And energy used to be a lot harder to come by.
So at the end of the day, it does come down to the energy imbalance. The intake and the expenditure have to be out of balance in order to change weight. But it's all of these other physiological signals that are driving the intake and the expenditure that we need to understand better in order to be able to achieve weight loss for everyone.
We're simplifying the science here, but needless to say, these are complicated things to study. And it helps to have a dedicated research facility like Pennington with all its bells and whistles focused on it. Remember how earlier I said that Pennington feels like a college campus? It's actually officially part of Louisiana State University, which is also in Baton Rouge, a few miles away. Back in the 1980s, the head of LSU got the billionaire oil man Claude Bernard Pennington to commit $125 million to start a nutrition research center. Over the decades since, the center has been involved in some of the most important research done about weight and weight-related conditions.
At the Pennington Biomedical Research Center.
At the Pennington Biomedical Research Center.
Researchers from the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Louisiana found
Pennington Biomedical.
Pennington Biomedical Research Center.
The Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge.
So, to summarize, studies, including ones done at Pennington, have shown that when people eat less, they lose weight. Calories matter. Pretty self-explanatory. But as we just talked about, calories also aren't the full story. There's this big gulf between what happens in research studies at places like Pennington, with its gadgets and gizmos, and the real world. And scientists are also still learning more about how your body seems to fend off long-term weight loss. So, what does all this add up to? It means that weight loss is more complicated than advertised. A lot more complicated. It also means that losing weight isn't fully in a person's control, even though that's how we tend to talk about it. Reasons like this are why scientists and doctors have started to call obesity a disease, the same way that diabetes and cancer are diseases. And if obesity is a disease, dieting takes on even more importance. It's not just a way to lose weight, but also a form of medical treatment. And if diets are medicine, surely we know what the best diet is for a person, right?
The great diet debate, low carb or low fat?
High fat diets actually may be superior to low fat diet.
In the low carbohydrate groups, they lost about 2.5 to 5 pounds more than those in the low fat diet group.
Carbohydrates are the single most important thing you can eat for health and weight loss. And you're thinking right now, Dr. Hyman, have you gone nuts?
Practically each decade has had a new dietary villain. First, fat was bad. And then carbs were bad. Now, I think maybe they're both still bad, but so is sugar too. Right? Where did we land on all that? I'll answer that in a minute. First, though, back to Pennington. As I spoke with scientists at the center, I kept feeling like I was going in circles. They would tell me how complicated weight loss turns out to be, how there's so much variability between people, and not just with burning calories, but in terms of how easily people lose or gain weight, that there's still so much scientists are learning. And then I would ask them, well, what should people do if they want to lose weight? And they would say, diet. Eat fewer calories.
And so I'm going to get the person to write down everything that they eat and drink for the next 5 days, and we're going to look at where the excess calories are coming from, and we're going to start there.
I told Leanne how confused I was by this. How can it be more complicated than calories in, calories out? But also that calories in, calories out is the answer. And then Leanne tells me something that just might haunt me forever. Remember our metabolic chamber from earlier? The sad little rooms? She and her colleagues at Pennington did a study where they put people in there. And the scientists actually overfed these people on purpose. They gave them 40% more calories than needed. They were trying to make them gain weight. And this is what they learned.
Some people will burn majority of the excess calories that they've eaten, and they're the people that will maintain their weight. Some people will burn 50% of those 40% extra. Some people will burn none.
And Leanne says they've also found that the opposite is true. When you give people less to eat, some people lose weight immediately, and others just don't. In other words, it's calories in, calories out, but only for some people. So, what I'm taking away from all this is, if you are a person who wants to lose weight, we don't have great information for you. Dieting, calories in, calories out.
It's the best we have.
Another way of putting all this is, other people get to eat as many honey buns from the vending machine as they want and just burn it all off. But you don't. By the way, there are other options for weight loss besides diet, like medication and surgery. But they're used a lot less. I was struck by what Leanne said, though. For all the newfangled machinery and fancy gadgets we toured earlier, the answer is that we still don't have an answer. Even though dieting doesn't work in a long-term way for many people, dieting is still the best we've got. And yet, the dogma is still, why don't you just diet? No uncertainty. No caveats, none of the nuance we uncovered here at Pennington. I asked Leanne about the uncertainty, about the lack of sufficient answers, a couple of times. Until finally, she said this.
You know, we've spent billions of dollars trying to understand obesity and weight management and how it affects people and how we can help people. And it just seems like it's all going into a black hole because, you know, even with that huge investment, we have no answers.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You just heard Leanne Redman, an expert in physiology at Pennington, saying that despite all the money that's been invested in weight loss, not to mention all the fancy equipment and scientists who have spent their careers working on the subject, we have no answers. We have no answers. In fact, that's exactly why we keep coming back to diets. They're not the answer, but they are the closest we've gotten to an answer. Then again, there are a lot of diets out there. The South Beach diet, low fat, Whole 30. So many diets. Which ones actually work the best? I put the question to Christopher Gardner, a nutrition scientist at Stanford.
Okay, this is a super depressing answer that nothing works because we haven't resolved the obesity epidemic.
Ugh, I know. This is getting really frustrating, right?
One of the things that we do know is that there isn't one diet for everyone. So people who claim that it's my diet or it's the paleo or the keto or the something else, it's not true.
Let's say I invented a diet. It's named after me, obviously. And I go around telling everyone, look, this is the diet that's going to finally make you lose weight. Basically, what I'm saying is,
I tried Emma's diet and it was awesome and everybody should try Emma's diet. And what I do as a scientist is I get 100 people and I assign 50 to Emma's diet and 50 to the other diet. And I have to see that, yeah, way more people on diet A work than diet B. And it usually doesn't happen. And so what we found is that there isn't one diet for everyone.
The big problem is keeping it up. I don't eat carbs until I'm craving them so much that I give in. I don't eat out until it starts crushing my social life. All diets have at least this in common.
What's the best diet to be on? It's the one you can maintain.
In other words, if you can keep up a low-carb diet, power to you. Same for a low-fat diet. But how do you know at the outset which one is going to work for you? That's where lots of scientists across this field are now channeling their efforts. The consensus now is that diets should be individually matched to a person based on different factors about them. Kind of like dating. My diet biography might say, Emma Court, journalist, sits at a desk all day, works out a few days a week, loves her kale salads, sweet tooth. But there's still a lot missing from that description. Things that I couldn't tell you, and even Pennington scientists can't use right now to match me to a diet. Like, what's going on in my gut microbiome? That's the collection of bacteria involved in digestion and metabolism. What about my genetics? Those are factors that could help you match a person better to a specific diet, or what's known as precision health. But
it's very hard to find the genetics or the metabolism so far that would point you to one diet or another.
We're not there yet, not by a long shot. Scientists are trying to figure it out, though. In fact, the National Institutes of Health is just starting to fund a study about this. So again, low-fat diets aren't the best diet for everyone. Neither is low-carb. Diets may have to be tailored to the individual. All the research on dieting and weight loss over the years has brought scientists to this conclusion. I know. But the thing is, for all we don't know about weight loss, there are some things we do know. We actually know a fair amount about the people who lose weight and keep it off. What they do and what it takes.
There was a sense of it's pretty hopeless. Nobody really succeeds in weight management. If you're obese, you're just out of luck because, you know, there's not much you can do about it. People try to diet, but it doesn't work.
That was James Hill, who is chair of nutrition sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's talking about how, in the late 1980s, rates of obesity began rising very suddenly. Remember, we talked about this earlier, how those rates had been stable beforehand, but they've risen and risen until today. And again, As all this is happening, people are feeling pretty hopeless about losing weight. So James and his colleague, Rena Wing, who is a professor at Brown University's medical school, decide to start tracking successful dieters. They created the National Weight Control Registry, which people can join if they have lost at least 30 pounds and kept it off for at least a year. There are more than 10,000 members today. James says that the registry was supposed to answer a key question. What does it take to lose weight long term? And the registry has actually provided some answers, as evidenced by 30 scientific papers James and his colleagues have written about it. That's right. We know what it takes to lose weight long term. You just have to diet and exercise, and prioritize it every single day, and work really hard. Forever.
So one of the things I always tell people that we've learned from the National Weight Control Registry, it takes a lot of conscious effort for these people to stay successful. So it's not the case of they lost weight and then they went back to living their lives and didn't think about it.
You might remember from our last episode that this is a diet myth the South Beach diet helped spread in the 2000s.
They prioritized their weight very, very highly.
Of all the people who diet, and there are many, very few of them actually end up joining the registry. We'll talk about that more in a bit. First, though, here's what we know about people in the National Weight Control Registry. Most of them eat a relatively low-fat diet, but some people do the low-carb thing too. Again, the specific diet doesn't seem to matter. That, these folks diet, seems to matter more than what kind of diet.
Most of them spend probably more time than the average person thinking about their diet during the day, thinking about what they eat, keeping track. A lot of them keep diet diaries, so they pay attention to the food they eat.
National Weight Control Registry members weigh themselves every day. They track what they eat and how much physical activity they get. They're also all exercising about an hour a day.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
Jane Fonda, an 80s exercise icon, wanted everyone to feel the burn, not just National Weight Control Registry participants. If you're thinking that an hour a day is a lot of exercise, you're right. The U.S. government recommends a few hours of exercise a week, and most adults aren't even doing that. I spoke with five members of the National Weight Control Registry for this episode and heard similar things. For starters, nearly all of them exercise intensely most days, and a lot have adopted some pretty extreme habits to keep their weight off over time. One guy I spoke with, his name is Marcos Goodman, told me that he had lost 65 pounds 8 years ago. To keep it off, he eats the same five or six meals every day, so he doesn't have to track different foods. Like for breakfast, oatmeal with flaxseed and sesame seeds, a banana and some non-fat milk. A stew for lunch, made of either sardines or chicken. And then an evening meal of soybeans. Another woman I spoke to, Susan Pierce Thompson, lost 60 pounds 18 years ago and has since then maintained her weight by cutting out flour and sugar completely. Susan ended up starting her own weight loss program based on those ideas. But the thing that struck me the most was the mental and emotional energy all these people spent on simply maintaining the weight that they had lost. It just became this big part of their lives. For some of them, their lives even sort of seemed to revolve around this one thing.
No one ever says, this is going to be really painful. You better get ready, because you are going to suffer. No one ever says that. And I did suffer tremendously.
This is Daisha Gill, a 56-year-old stay-at-home mom who lives in Dallas, Texas. She's talking about the process of losing weight, what it was like for her.
I don't know if you've ever tried to sleep when you're really, really hungry. Not just wanting to eat, but truly feeling like you're starved. That's how I had to feel every night.
Daisha says she has struggled with her weight since she was 11 years old. She told me that she started off binging on candy bars at summer camp.
I was always very interested in health and longevity, and I wanted to be active and athletic, and but who I felt like and what I looked like could not have been any more opposite. And I found it humiliating and embarrassing to look at myself and for people to see how I looked. I was repulsed and so ashamed all the time, all the time.
Daisha says she has probably read hundreds of weight loss books. She's tried Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Overeaters Anonymous. She got a lap band, a surgical procedure that constricts the stomach. She even tried hypnosis. None of it worked. She also says she experienced health issues that seemed related to her weight, like fatty liver disease and asthma. Daisha knew she needed to make a major change. She begins shifting how she eats and ends up losing 110 pounds. But she's also raising sons, which means lots of tempting foods in the house.
I did research and found these food safes that have timers on them. And so I bought some food safes so that I could put the food that I had trouble controlling myself with in those food safes so that my sons could get them. Or if I wanted a treat at some point, I could time it so that I couldn't get into the food safe until I said that I could.
Daisha still uses those food safes. They're made of plastic and have a dial at the top. She sets them to unlock over periods of hours or days, so she can't eat, say, candy or chocolate whenever she wants. She also keeps a fridge near her bedroom in case she gets the urge to eat late at night. There are protein bars in there, as well as apples and bottles of water.
It keeps me from going downstairs and eating 4,000 calories because I can't sleep and I'm upset about something that happened that day.
Daisha also spends about 5 days a week exercising for 90 minutes. She has a special playlist of upbeat music that she listens to when she exercises. And only when she exercises. Like, let's say she gets a craving to listen to those songs at another time. It happens a lot, in fact. But Daisha doesn't do it. She won't let herself.
So anything I can do to spice it up and make it different, and because it is easy to stop feeling motivated, especially when you're basically at your goal. But I do find new ways to constantly motivate myself and make it fun. It has to be fun.
The measures that successful dieters take, in other words, can take over their lives. This is the part that's usually missed about the National Weight Control Registry. Sure, these people have all lost large amounts of weight and kept it off for many years. But what it has taken to get them there is totally unreasonable. It just doesn't seem possible for most people, or even worth it.
And you always find a few people who are able to lose a lot of weight.
This is Glenn Gaser, a professor at Arizona State University, who's criticized the National Weight Control Registry.
Most people are unwilling to do what it takes to get the weight loss that they would like.
Things like lock your favorite snacks in a safe.
So there's a huge gap between what people would like to weigh and what is feasible.
Glenn has actually done some math to figure out how many dieters make it to the National Weight Control Registry. In other words, lots of people diet, how many lose at least 30 pounds and keep it off for a year or more? About 125 million Americans try to lose weight each year. So,
the 10,000 people that are in the National Weight Control Registry represent about one out of every 12,500 U.S. adults trying to lose weight.
As in, for every person in it, there are probably 12,499 people who didn't lose that kind of weight or didn't keep the weight loss off. That means registry participants aren't even the 1%. They're the 0.008%.
But the point is that the people who are in the National Weight Control Registry are just a very, very small drop in the big bucket of people.
James Hill, the registry's co-founder, who we talked to earlier, actually sort of agrees with some of the criticism.
This is not for the faint of heart. If you're going to succeed, you're going to have to put time and effort into it for the foreseeable future. This idea, you know, sort of the American idea is go out and go on a diet and then everything will be fine, right? It doesn't happen. Most people who lose weight regain it.
The hardest part, James says, is keeping it off. He's responded to some of these critiques by starting a whole new project. It's called the International Weight Control Registry, and it launched last year. This new registry is tracking a much wider group of people, including those who have not been able to lose weight. The team is also trying to reach a more diverse group of members. The National Weight Control Registry's typical member is 40 or 50 years old, and generally a white woman. I kept thinking about how much people in the registry who have kept weight loss off have had to diet and exercise. For some of them, it became so all-encompassing that they turned it into a profession. They became dietitians or personal trainers. And it seemed like it was worth it for them. Many of the things they did probably did help make them healthier. And they probably started thinking of themselves differently too, as someone really fit, with a lot of willpower and determination. Like Daisha.
I basically did something that I wouldn't have been able to do according to science, according to everything that I've ever read.
And in a way, Daisha and the others have new lives now. But that number on the scale still rules their time, their energy, their interests, and their identities. They're afraid of what will happen if they stop dieting and exercising, because they might gain the weight back. Even though they've gotten what they wanted, they still live with a lot of fear. So maybe you're wondering, why diet anyway? The backlash against dieting is very much at our doorstep.
So I really don't like the word diet. That word to me is just so negative, and it's just, you know, the thoughts that come with that word are like deprivation, starving, and just not getting to have anything good. And I mean,
in our next episode, we'll look at how diet has become sort of a four-letter word. But has it really gone away? Some of the people in the biggest rush away from dieting, they actually run weight loss companies.
It's different, something that I can actually live with. I wouldn't even call it a diet.
Losing It is written and reported by me, Emma Court, and edited by Kristen B. Brown. Magnus Henriksen is our senior producer. Stacey Wong, our associate producer, and Blake Maples is our audio engineer. Our theme was composed and performed by Hannes Brown. Thanks to Francesca Levy and Tim Annette. Be sure to subscribe to Prognosis if you haven't already. And if you like our show, please leave us a review. That helps others find out about it. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.